Right now, I think there is a lot of strategy, unfortunately, coming out of the right wing that a lot of us on the left are navigating defense or rapid response around. And I think there's this thing I always remember is that there's more of us than them. And this is what happens when your enemy is scared.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Kelly Hayes, one of the co-authors of Let This Radicalize You. We wanted to kick things off with some gratitude, because we are really just overflowing with gratitude in this moment, more than we have time to address here, but I'm going to give it a shot. I first want to say how thankful I am for my co-author and dear friend, Miriam Kaba, who had an idea for a zine that kind of got away from us and became a book. I also want to shout out my collective, Lifted Voices. I think a bunch of you are watching tonight, and I love you all so much. And I have learned so much from and with you all. I love you dearly. I want to thank Maya Shenwar for her amazing edits on this book as it was growing and finding its form. Working with Maya is one of the great joys of my life whenever she edits my work. I know anytime we're working together that we're going to turn out something special. And her work with me and Miriam on this book was no exception. Maya is really a gift to us all, and I love her so much. I am also really grateful to you all for joining us to celebrate the launch of Let This Radicalize You, a book that many of you contributed to either directly or indirectly. A lot of wonderful people, including our friends on this call, were interviewed for this book. Our comrades shared their victories, their stumbles, their hopes, and the lessons they learned along the way. And I know I am better for having heard those stories, so I can only imagine what it would have been like to enjoy their wisdom earlier in my work. I know that in some of the darkest hours of the last few years, when it felt like the walls were closing in, I was blessed to have these people as my guides, leading me forward with their words as we worked on this project, and I couldn't be more grateful for that. I also want to thank everyone who contributed to this book by organizing and fighting alongside us over the years. The dedication at the front of this book reads, "This book is dedicated to the people we have marched, wept, laughed, and planned alongside. Everything worthwhile is done with other people." If you're among those people we have marched, wept, laughed, and planned alongside, then you are part of this book, and I hope you feel honored by its creation and by whatever good it does in the world, because without you all, we would have no stories to tell and no lessons to share about how to do this work. We would just be people with a lot of opinions, ideas, and frustrations. Friendship and camaraderie and shared struggle have made all of the best things in my life possible, including this book. And I want to thank you all for that. Also, a big shout out to everyone who pre-ordered and everyone who is buying the book this week. The reason we have been so focused on these early sales is that our early momentum is going to determine how widely available this book is. And the more momentum we have, the more likely we are to see this book find its intended audience, which is organizers, particularly newer organizers, but really anyone doing justice work who might benefit from it. And I am grateful to you all for making that possible. Miriam?
Hello, 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 everyone. Thank you so much for being here. Welcome to this you know, virtual launch event. Making a book is always a collaborative effort, and there isn't enough time for me to list every single person I want to thank this evening, or we would be here until tomorrow, and I don't think anybody wants that. So I'm going to limit myself to lifting up a few people and beg forgiveness from everyone else. My gratitude to my teachers, touchstones, comrades, without whom I would not have any of the knowledge that I've gathered over the past few decades. Some of those people are here with us tonight. All of those people are here with us tonight. My gratitude to our amazing and wonderful editor, Maya Shenwar, who really gave direction and shape to our words and is a wonderful co-struggler, comrade of long standing. Appreciate you, Maya. Thank you to all of the experienced organizers who graciously and generously shared their ideas and wisdom with us over the years and for this book in particular. Thank you to Harsha Walia for writing the afterword for this book. Thank you to Kai Yangmi for your beautiful cover art. Thank you to my family who really make everything I do possible and always encourage me. My gratitude to Haymarket Books and to the entire team there who are really the best partners. Really appreciate you. I want to thank those who read parts of this book all the way through and offered invaluable feedback along the way. I want to thank all the people who read the book and then shared your generous blurbs and endorsements with us. We really, really appreciate it. I want to call out Rachel Zafer, Ursula Roca Wolf, Sayari Rafai, Lulu and Devika and Max, and others who worked on the resources that we created to complement this book. And there are many resources, and we are really excited to share them with you. Thanks to my friends and collaborators at Project NIA, at Interrupting Criminalization, and Survived and Punished for your patience, support, and inspiration, and for holding a lot of the work while I was doing this other work. And I'm going to end with my profound gratitude for Kelly, who is one of the most treasured thought partners I've had, who is one of my best comrades, and most especially one of my really trusted and beloved friends. It really was a joy to collaborate with you on this book. Really, Let This Radicalize You, for me, is a book that I wish I had when I was early in my activism and organizing, and that's really what we set out to create. It's a book that I will share with the newer and younger organizers who reach out to me with questions, who are seeking guidance often that I don't have. But this collected wisdom, I hope, will be an accompaniment and a soft place to land for you. I'm so happy that it's out in the world. And I hope that those who engage with the book will take what serves you and leave the rest aside. There'll be lots of things you may not agree with in the book, and that's cool. No two organizers or activists are the same, and we might offer very different ideas from each other or from what's in this book, and that's as it should be. I look forward to reading what others produce in the coming weeks and months and years based on your experience and your ideas. And as importantly, this is a word of mouth book. We are counting on you to, if you read it and you appreciate it, to share it with at least one other person. Finally, I just want to talk about the most important thing ever, the reason you're all here, which is the raffle. Hopefully, you will see on, I'm sorry, I couldn't help it. Okay. You will see on the screen that there's a link to a raffle form that we have. And we love to give gifts. That's a huge part of life. So we're going to be selecting 15 winners who will receive two posters. You'll see them reflected on the slide that John shows. Those posters are by Corey Lynn and by Sayari Rafai. And along with, we'll add some stickers, magnets, postcards to what we send to you. And we hope that you will enjoy that raffle prize. Don't trip over each other in filling out the form. We're going to be accepting signups until around midnight tonight. So make sure you include also your full mailing address, which includes any apartment or suite numbers so that the materials can actually reach you and get to you. So with that, I think we're going to move on to reading a bit from this book. Each of us have selected a very short piece that we want to read, and I'm going to kick it back to Kelly to kick us off.
Thanks, Miriam. So the section that I am going to read is from my introduction. This book is intended for organizers who are young in their work, though we hope it will be beneficial to others as well. In thinking about what to include in a book for people who are newer to movement work, I thought about how I had learned and grown as an organizer and what had been most helpful to me. One answer seemed particularly relevant: long talks with mentors on the way home from protests. When Miriam and I first began co-organizing events together, we lived in the same part of Chicago. So after a long night of marching or rallying outside police headquarters, we would often wind up in the same car on the way home. Sometimes Miriam would be driving, but she would always be talking. She would talk about the action and its relationship to the moment. She would share histories and personal anecdotes, ask questions and recommend books. We would not always agree, but our dialogues were so constructive that I enjoyed being challenged by Miriam. In a world that often shames us for what we do not know, I found those conversations enlivening and at times life-changing. By the time I got out of the car, I would feel curious, creative, and ready to learn or do more. I have experienced similar moments with other organizers on road trips to protests, in coffee shops, or sitting on sidewalks at jail support during the hours-long wait for the release of other protesters. I came to think of those conversations as rides home too, even if they did not take place in a vehicle, because there was something about that descriptor that I liked, the idea of an important conversation that helped bring me home. Those talks helped to shape my perspective as an organizer, and they have also helped me grapple with tough questions about myself and about movement work. Some of the people I was lucky enough to have those conversations with, in addition to Miriam, are featured in this book. Because while this book is a mashup of manifesto, anecdotes, and advice, my greatest hope for this project is to create a book full of rides home. We know that many of you will be taking action in the days ahead, and that some of you are already hard at work trying to remake the world. We are so grateful for you. We know what you are up against in the form of state repression, and that you have inherited a world on fire. We share your fears and your fury, and we trust your creativity. If you are completely new to the work of movements, welcome. Please know that you are needed, and that while your journey will be messy, possibility is worth it. We talk a lot about possibility and hope in this book, and we are by no means attempting to minimize the stakes or the obstacles you will face in your work. I know these are frightening and even soul-shaking times. I cannot tell you that the tumult will relent, because it will not. But I can tell you that here, on the edge of everything, we are each other's best hope. As organizers, we are builders in an era of collapse. Our work is set against all probability, and it is in that space of cherished improbability where our art will be made, where our joy will be found, and where our ingenuity will fashion new ways of living and caring for one another. Even as the ground shifts beneath our feet, life will be a scramble, but we will not scramble alone. Together, we will fight for this world, to keep it. Although we hope to cross paths with many of you in the streets or wherever we hold our ground collectively against injustice, the limits of time and space mean we probably won't see you at your next protest. But it is my sincere hope that through this book, we still might be able to offer you a ride home.
Thank you so, so much, Kelly. That was beautiful and just, I think, a really wonderful capsule of what we are trying to do with this book. So thank you for that reading. For those of you who have a copy of the book, I'm going to read from my conclusion on page 229, starting there. An important thing to do when injustices compound is to resist numbness. In order for change and transformation to occur, we must refuse the current order of the world. What does this mean? It doesn't mean repeating the buzz phrase, "This is not normal." It means active refusal to become numb to the horror. Mm-hmm. The renowned poet, writer, and activist Dion Brand warns, "If I am peaceful in this discomfort, is not peace, is getting used to harm." Of course, turning away from the news, quote unquote, intermittently is essential for one's well-being. The people I most admire, like organizer Ella Baker, remind us that the tribe increases, the struggle is eternal, somebody else carries on. These touchstones are also honest about their disappointments and doubts. They don't wake up every day feeling prepared to confront oppression or looking forward to struggle. Many days I'm annoyed as hell at my fellow human beings and express this to anyone within the sound of one of my rants. Some days I want to ignore what's happening in the world, stay in bed and watch the Hallmark Channel. So I do. It isn't realistic or sustainable to never take a break from the relentlessness of injustice. The struggle is eternal, but our energies are limited. Still, it's important to stay invested and interested in the stories of people who are suffering under the current regime. To turn away from that suffering is tacit complicity with the current systems of violence. It is getting used to harm. Once again, here we can learn from Desmond Tutu, who said, "When we look squarely at injustice and get involved, we actually feel less pain, not more, because we overcome the gnawing guilt and despair that festers under our numbness. We clean the wound, our own and others, and it can finally heal." So how will you lessen suffering where you are? There are times when I feel overwhelmed about what to do, where to start. The problems seem so big and so intractable. In those times, I ask myself a set of questions that serve as guideposts and help to ground me. What resources exist that I can better educate myself? Who's already doing work around this injustice? Do I have the capacity to offer concrete support and help to them? How can I be constructive? I shared these questions on Twitter a few years ago, and it is still my pinned tweet. I've heard from others that they find them helpful. You are not needed everywhere, but we are all needed somewhere. It's important to find your somewhere and plant yourself there. There are other things you can do as you answer the question of how you will lessen suffering today. The first step is to refuse to accept that nothing can be done and that nothing will or can change. Don't be cynical. Sincerity is a virtue. I'm a fan of uncynical people who don't justify their inaction by suggesting that nothing will change. If you are faltering at internalizing the fact that change is constant, find others to remind you. In fact, everything is changing all of the time. We must remember the teachings of visionary world builder Octavia Butler, who wrote in Parable of the Sower, "All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change." So how do we make change happen? You as an individual are only a tiny pebble in a vast sea. You can personally make ripples, but it takes collective action to make waves. It may be unfashionable or too earnest to say, but the reality is that each of us bringing our pebbles to the lake and throwing them in is what it takes to make change. I think the image of an endless line of us throwing our pebbles into the lake is beautiful. a necessary act taken together. Of course, collective action is not the only ingredient to make transformative change. We also need sound strategy and resources, and we need radical imagination. Radical imagination is essential to organizing and also important to me because the horizon that I am working toward is a world I have never seen, a world without policing, imprisonment, or surveillance. As my friend, writer, artist, and scholar Eve Ewing says, in order to create pathways toward that which we have never seen, we have to lead with imagination. All of the most important and impactful social transformations happened because people fought and struggled for things they had never seen. My comrade, okay, I'm skipping this part, and I'm going to. We all have a role to play in building those new worlds. Determine what the next right step is for you. There is always something that is worth doing. Find your lane and push ahead. Make connections with others. Refuse to acquiesce to despair. Imagine your way forward. There are many ways that things can be different in the world, and we don't know how things will turn out. So we might as well fight like hell for the world we want to inhabit. History teaches us that relatively small groups of people have been responsible for some of the most consequential societal changes. It's usually the minority of the minority that engages in struggle in any historical moment. This is reassuring because it means that we don't have to convince everyone in order to attain critical goals. It leaves room for surprise. If you are reading this book, then you have been chosen to be a helper. You've been enlisted to take constructive action. As playwright Anna Deavere Smith advises, start now, every day, becoming in your actions, your regular actions, what you would like to become in the bigger scheme of things. Though we can't stop all suffering, we can each work to lessen suffering for someone else. My attention is focused on looking for and trying to nurture the things that will lessen suffering. Every day, I commit to bringing my imperfect and small actions to the pile. What are those concrete actions for you? Thank you all for listening to us talk and read from this book. We hope that this doesn't actually make you not want to read the rest of the book. This was not our intention if we did that. So in order to get you back, we're going to be, I'm going to pass back to Kelly to bring our friends who are our special guests to the fore tonight. We're so grateful for them. And we are excited to be in conversation with them. So Kelly.
Thanks, Miriam. At this time, I would like to invite our guests to take a minute or two each to introduce themselves to our audience. I'm sure a lot of folks know exactly who y'all are, but for those who don't, please tell them a little bit about yourselves. Ajeris, would you like to kick off for us?
Sure. So first of all, I'm so grateful to be here with you. So grateful for Kelly and Miriam for putting this incredible book together. My name's Ajeris Dixon. I use they and she pronouns. I'm a longtime organizer and strategist. I started organizing in the late 90s as a gaby, really focusing on the intersections of racial, economic justice, state violence, violence against queer and trans people. I'm the executive director of a group called Vision Change Win, which really focuses on centering the centering Black, queer, and trans communities, and also supporting organizations around the intersections of community organizing, safety and security, and organizational development. I'm also the principal of Ejeri Labs, which is at the intersection of strategy and political education around addressing and contending with fascism and building transformative futures. I'm the co-editor of a book called Beyond Survival, Strategies and Stories for the Transformative Justice Movements. I am an organizing, fascism, transformative justice, and abolition geek, and I'm a big fan of everybody here.
Ruthie, would you like to share?
Good afternoon, good evening, everybody. I'm Ruthie Wilson Gilmore. I am thrilled to be here. Thank you, Mariam and Kelly, and everybody who worked with you and with us to make this fantastic book possible. I am a fan of everybody here. This is quite a fan situation, I believe, that we're in. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing. Though we don't have to love the people we struggle with, it's really nice when we do. We don't have to admire the people that we work with. It's really nice when we do. My day job is I'm a professor. I teach at the City University of New York Graduate Center. I'm a geographer by training, and I have a whole chapter in the book that's just about me. Not really, but sort of. And I direct the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the Grad Center. What else can I say? I've co-founded many, many, many organizations over the years, and I'm really deep into doing a whole lot of fairly new for me, meaning last 10 years, work internationally with comrades kind of all around the Atlantic seaboard as well as the Indian Ocean.
Ali, would you like to share?
Yeah, and I'm going to basically repeat what everyone said. I'm so honored to be on here. In fact, so honored that earlier on I was asking myself, like, I'm literally on a panel with, like, people whose work I've admired so much for so long. What am I even doing here? And then I remembered I was reading the book, and I was thinking to myself, none of this work is individual. Like, I'm not coming here to talk about my work. I'm coming here to talk about the work that I have done with so many other people. So I'm representing them, and that feels good and centering. Right, like I said, my name is Ali Wayne, pronounced he, him, his, undocumented activist originally from Senegal, and then had to learn what it meant to be Black in the U.S. It's been a doozy. I started out organizing actually out of Chicago with the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago in the early 2000s. And I actually am really happy that one of my mentors, Mary Zirkel, is here to listen. She's someone who took a chance on me when I was fully undocumented and I didn't have any sense of what I wanted to do in the world. And she took me in, and it's 2023 and I'm still here doing the work. I've done a lot of work on anti-war issues, economic justice issues, global justice. And my work recently has been at the intersection of migrants' rights issues and racial justice issues. As an undocumented and Black person, I often tell people that I became an abolitionist quite organically. My current position right now is I'm on the board, the advisory board of the Immigrant Justice Network. But my home group is the Syracuse Peace Council here in Syracuse, New York. And I've organized with Black Lives Matter Syracuse, the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, the UndocuBlack Network, and a whole host of other groups. And just really happy to be in this conversation with people that I love. And I can't wait to promote this book. You know, like a lot of people said, as I was reading the book, I was just nodding furiously and thinking, like, oh, well, that lesson took me, like, I don't know, 2 years to figure out, or, you know, 3 years or however long. And I'm just so excited that young activists are going to be able to just gain from that wisdom and hopefully be able to skip through all of the trial and error. So grateful to be here.
Thank you all so much for that. So our opening question for this conversation is, if we're looking back on our current moment in 50 years, what is the story that we would tell about the state of our society and our social movements? Anyone feel free to jump in on that.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Abolition for the People, The Movement for a Future Without Policing and Prisons, edited by Colin Kaepernick. Abolition for the People brings together 30 essays representing a diversity of voices: political prisoners, grassroots organizers, scholars, and relatives of those killed by the anti-Black terrorism of policing and prisons. Powered by courageous hope and imagination, Abolition for the People provides a blueprint and vision for creating an abolitionist future where communities can be safe, valued, and truly free. Another world is possible, Kaepernick writes, a world grounded in love, justice, and accountability, a world grounded in safety and good health, a world grounded in meeting the needs of the people. As Combahee River Collective co-founder Barbara Smith says of the collection, Kaepernick has assembled a community of visionary thinkers who unequivocally show that the path to freedom requires abolition. Find Abolition for the People at haymarketbooks.org.
I'll jump. Is that all right? Okay. So, as you can imagine, I've been thinking about this a long time along with everybody else. And a few years ago, my friend, the great Naomi Murakawa, who's also an editor at Haymarket, as well as all the other things she does, threw me a challenge by giving a book, which I haven't turned into the press yet, a subtitle, Racial Capitalism and the Case for Abolition. And it's been something that I've been worrying over for almost 3 years. So here's where I'm at. And it's this: there's no struggle today that isn't shaped by expected or actual confrontation with the forces of organized violence. Whether we're talking about labor, housing, water, climate, healthcare, gender and sexuality, land use, migration, transportation, you name it. That is, insofar as all of these struggles within and against racial capitalism arise from or in resistance to organized abandonment, the adversarial capacity to sustain immiseration, the capacity to allocate benefits and resources at the margins while principally presiding over the upward motion of money and wealth, requires the forces of organized violence to enforce ineligibility, to restrict access, and to seize resources. The forces of organized violence, therefore, are facts as well as boots on the ground. So to get from here to an emancipated future, what the assassinated youth and leader Lindo Kule Mgune of Abashali-based Jondolo said before he was killed, socialism or death. To get from here to an emancipated future means going through abolition. Therefore, dialectically, abolition, to get there, must be green. To be green, it must be red. And to be red, it must be international. So that's my story.
That's why we have Ruthie lead. And I was just captivated by that. So what I've been really thinking about is how if I'm looking back from 50 years later, you know, so I'm on a porch. I'm a serious elder. I'm a little crotchety and even more honest than I am now. And it's really hard to know you're in a turning point when you're in a turning point, but I think that's what we're in right now. And I think that this is the moment where we shifted some fundamental practices around care, around relationships, and around strategy. And what I've seen in my time within movement work is that at different points, we are attentive to one of those better than other. Right, that we can be attentive to strategy with, but not care. That we can think about the relationships or the bases that we're building, but not always be attentive to strategy. And I actually think that this moment requires all and all together. And I feel really excited about some of the conversations that people are talking around. How do we address conflict in our movements? How do we build spaces that are aligned with the visions that we seek? How do we talk about abolition in a way that is infectious to as a mass-based movement, right? I'm just really, I think that we are honing ourselves into organizing strategies out of our own survival, out of the way that right now I think there is a lot of strategy, unfortunately, coming out of the right wing that a lot of us on the left are navigating like defense or rapid response around. And I think there's this thing I always remember is that there's more of us than them. And this is what happens when your enemy is scared. And so I think of this moment as a turning point where we start to think about how do we take care of each other in the way that we can have mass-based movements that win without leaving any of us behind.
Yeah, and I don't have much to add because I agree with everything. The one, you know, when I got that sort of general question around sort of the 50 years and everything, I've actually been thinking a lot about this, about, like, currently I'm actually not organizing. I'm just mostly doing writing and speaking, but I've been thinking about time periods, you know, and sort of time chunks and how things are constantly shifting. You know, right now, so a lot of my work is on immigration. And if you look at what's been happening at the border, if you look at what's been happening of criminalization of Black and brown people, I mean, it just looks like we're in such a place of cynicism and darkness. And yet at the same time, a way for me to ground myself is ask myself, well, where were we 20, 30, 40 years ago? And I keep imagining, and actually not imagining, and maybe it's kind of faith, it's a kind of knowing that when my time is gone, you know, when I'm done with whatever piece of the work that I have to do, other people are going to rise up and they're going to keep doing the work that I care about. And that is so grounding to think of in terms of the long-term struggle. In terms of where we are now specifically, what I would say is that we are definitely in the age of radical mutual aid, reciprocal care. I think as it's becoming clearer and clearer that the state has abdicated its responsibilities to take care of its people. I mean, we just had a brutal example of that, you know, during this COVID pandemic crisis, which was practically eugenicist in terms of the way the government abdicated its responsibilities to its more vulnerable populations. But the other side of that was watching people organize and take care of each other and take care of themselves as the state figures out, you know, what the next steps are. And so I think it's kind of important to organize, to create spaces within the state where that care can happen. But at the same time, I am kind of encouraged at the fact that more and more people are just turning to each other for support. And I also think that this is a moment of deep intersectionality. And I'm talking about not just now, but like at least the past 10 years, what I've noticed in terms of organizing is less siloing of issues. More and more people realizing how interconnected our issues are. I had the pleasure of being one of many, many people who worked on an abolitionist immigration platform maybe a year or two ago. And one of the things that was exciting was like talking to people from the environmental rights movement, you know, indigenous community, you know, incarcerated people, and realizing how, you know, we're facing the same system of oppression. And what I think is really exciting is that more and more people are realizing that we are not anymore in single issue kind of spaces, that we're fighting the big blob sort of together. And one more thing that I do think is very, very encouraging is in the past couple of years, there's much more of an emphasis on mental health and healing justice, which was certainly not there when I started out organizing. When I started out organizing in Chicago, it was very like Saul Alinsky, kind of like militant, like kill yourself for the cause type of organizing. And by the time we got to the Movement for Black Lives, there were all these spaces where people were talking about, you know, healing justice as one of the political rights that we fight for and how important it is to take care of ourselves. And I say this not from a place of distance. You know, I'm someone who has struggled with depression for many years, and for many years I've told people, you know, I could not be able to do the work that I do if it weren't for the fact that I have been in counseling for many years, and that the counseling has actually helped me be a more effective organizer when I am, or activist or whatever. And I think that's really exciting to see that, especially if younger organizer, this recognition of like, oh no, the system does not deserve our physical or mental death, right? It doesn't deserve it. We're trying to create a better world. There's no point in like killing ourselves to get to this better world. We deserve joy as we walk towards the revolution. And I think that's something that is just really exciting to see and hopeful for me in terms of where we could be in the next couple of years.
Thanks, Ali. This is Miriam just jumping in to say that I think we have a really great example, particularly for those of us who have a lot of Chicago ties, of something that probably the rest of the country can't see in the same kind of way if you weren't as involved over the last two decades in what has been going on in that city. Perfect example of what Ruthie talks about around the forces of organized violence. I mean, my gosh, think about the CPD and its history of crushing everybody, right? And then the forces of organized abandonment. I mean, what is the closing of 50 schools and all of the public mental health clinics and the razzing of Cabrini of public housing? I mean, what is that is, you know, emblematic of what we're talking about here when we speak about organized abandonment of communities. But you saw in that groups of people who've come together, literally together, through a militant social justice focused, specific, explicit union that brought together educational workers, right, over time. And again, this is over time, many, many years. So the major loss of 50 schools also was a galvanizing moment for people to be like, okay, we got to do something different here. It's got to be something different, right? And we have to use strikes, and we have to be able to also, alongside that, a long history of groups that have been doing all kinds of other kinds of organizing in the city, housing and tenants' rights, abolitionist organizing of various kinds around closing prisons and detention centers, around fighting against surveillance through, you know, the shot spotter, around all of these different kinds of movements that came together, the United Families Union that came together to really kind of put together the ground game, Emma Tai and that crew, grassroots leadership, and under the leadership of Amisha Patel and others, all those years of fighting on the TIFFs, you know, that Rahm Emanuel was centering downtown and taking and like siphoning off the resources of the West and South Side and not giving back to those particular communities. And I'm not saying that one election makes a difference. I'm saying that the people in that city have been fighting for two decades against all of these forces to come together to try to use the lever of the election side with the lever of the community side, with a mass kind of mutual aid networks all over the map right now. Who is taking care of all the migrants that are being brought to the city in the ways that, you know, through the South and through the other places where they're busing in people by the hundreds of, you know, a day? It's community folks that are rallying. And what are they doing that based off of? They're doing that based off of the networks that were built in part through COVID, right? That still exist, that are able to be activated towards assisting. It's not the answer or the solution, but it's saving lives in the interim. That is not a small thing, you know? And I think we can look at all of that, and you cannot understand that without understanding the culture of organizing in the city that was exactly as Ali mentioned, intersectional in how it looks at things. There's the Portal Project and all the things that Barbara's been doing to bring people together across the city, but also across nationally and internationally, having conversations about what was going on a regular basis. You can't pinpoint one thing, but everything led to everything else. And everything will lead to other things into the future, things we can't expect, the surprises that we were not going to be able to envision sitting here that will happen 50 years from now out of the work we currently do and the work we did 10 years ago and the work we did 20 years ago and the work that came before that. So I think in just that small example, it isn't utopia and it's not intended to be. It isn't perfect and it's not intended to be. But what it is struggle that's ongoing. Those organizers that now have an ear at the mayor's office aren't stopping. They're not like just like, oh, cool, we've got a potential friend there. No, they're going to push because this is Chicago. And people already are complaining that they got left out of the inauguration and they shouldn't have gone. You know, like people are going to, that's going to continue to happen. And, you know, you need to do better. And we need to like, and people are ready for that. And I like to see that like exponentially grow in all the cities, right? People are pushing right now in Philadelphia for a different governance structure, and maybe they'll win. And maybe that will also be a space that will bring a lot of new things into being that can actually move us closer to where we need to go. So I guess for me, that those actual tangible examples make all the difference. And that's why we bring them up in the book, because I do think people forget often because we're in it. The feeling of overwhelm is real. Like, what is going on? It feels like every day something horrible is happening and we're all feeling it. We're all feeling that overwhelm. But sometimes what that overwhelm does is it actually makes people believe that nothing is happening that is good. And it also makes people feel really kind of intentionally that nothing can actually be done. That nothing can be done, which is the biggest lie. The biggest lie. There's always something that can be done. Ruthie teaches us that all the time. Right? There's always something that can be done. That's just, it's just not true. Like whatever, if that's being told to you or you're being, if that's being sweet whispers in your ear, like get rid of that idea. There's always something to do, especially if you're going to do it with other people and you're going to do it collectively. Right? So I just wanted to add my two cents in on that.
Thank you for that, Miriam. I agree with so much of what has been said. And I feel that so much of the moment that we're living in has been summed up. So I'll just focus on the aspirational for a moment, which is that when I think about the story that folks will be telling in 50 years and the story that I hope folks will be telling in 50 years about this moment, this time, I hope it's a story about how we found each other in dark, difficult times and how a ragtag movement of movements of people who gave a fuck in a world that told them not to, created a revolutionary counterculture of care that ultimately defeated the death makers. And that's what I hope the story looks like 50 years from now. So moving to our next question, is there a part or section of the book that you feel is particularly relevant or resonant or useful to this storytelling that we're talking about? Anyone can jump in.
Did Ajeris share 50 years?
I did. But I can jump in on this section.
Okay.
I can't pick one. I know that you all were gonna ask as to, but I can't. The ones that are really sitting with me right now, it's the section on burnout, the section on pedestaling, and the section on organizing isn't matchmaking. And maybe I'll just talk about the difference between pedestaling and organizing a bit, because I think it matters. What was both beautiful and hard about some aspects of what was happening during COVID was how much more we were navigating each other electronically and how so many of these tools, and I think social media is a tremendous tool for organizing, but there's also this piece around like all of the ways it encourages you to desire to become a celebrity and to make others a celebrity. And while presence is an influence and influencers, like while the ability to reach a lot of people can be useful, it's different than relationship building. And I think that I saw a lot of folks, particularly, you know, like folks who have a lot of hard lives and have reasons to like be like, I want to get out. I want a better life for myself. And therefore, I want to do what I can to be as famous as possible through whatever means I want. And I think there's this piece around what are we using the tools for, mm-hmm. that I think is really, really critical. And so recognizing that despite popular depictions of movements that usually involve like one charismatic person leading a meeting, and then all of a sudden there's an action and the march just happens. There were no, you know, meetings, arguments, and food or whatever to get there, but the march just happens and then there's winning and cheering. But despite the way that our movement work is depicted, it's just webs, right? It's webs of relationships, webs of intentional, nurtured relationships, webs of people who may or may not always like or love each other, but are committed to each other. Like those are some of the most powerful relationships I have that have a mix of struggle in them, but always like if something happens to you, I will still be there. And so I think there's this piece where we need each other. And so the thing I really think about is also the small pieces of relationship building. So like, how are we each bringing in one more person in our lives into movement work? Not in like a didactic, we can't talk about anything else kind of way, but in like a delicious invitation to make meaning together, mm-hmm. and to influence the things that are hard. Or even sometimes I think the biggest thing I've influenced in some of my movement work is people feeling powerful in that time period, in that moment, in a life where it's hard to feel powerful. And how much just those moments of power in actions, with policy wins, whatever it was, how much those moments of power change. I was thinking about people I used to organize with 10 to 15 years ago that I don't see as much anymore. But I was also thinking about that. I ran into this woman. We worked together when I was doing a lot of organizing around childcare workers in the city about 15 years ago. And I ran into her. I was at the bank. And she did outreach to me. And she's like, you need to get involved in this project on my block. Here's what's happening. You know, like we're trying to like address the gentrification, blah, 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 blah. And that once the spark is lit, you know, we hone it, we shift it, we take steps back. But it's a spark that continues and that we need. And so any chance I can talk about the importance of bringing folks into our movements and maintaining them, I will take it. but I also think and to connect it to the other section. And as I've said, the more of us that there are to care for each other and hold each other up, it's the best antidote to burnout that I know. Mm-hmm. So that's me hyping up my favorite section.
So I can share really quickly because I want to be respectful of our time here. I mean, just going to say the same thing as Ajeris, you know, just the book as a whole is so good that I don't just want to say like one portion is crucial. But certainly in terms of what I've been struggling with recently a lot is the problem of the pedestaling of activists and the kind of weird neoliberal celebrity activist place that we're arriving at. Now, I want to be clear, I'm not someone who is an ascetic and who's just kind of like, you know, activists should be like eating ramen noodles, you know, for the cause or whatever. Like, I want everyone to have a good, healthy, material life where they get to afford what they need, you know. That being said, I think over the years, I've known so many young, absolutely brilliant organizers be just given the spotlight, the money, the recognition way before they're ready for it. And I want to really have a space of like compassion for that, because it's so easy for us in organizing spaces as we sort of co-struggle to just be like, oh, well, this person is a sellout and I would have done differently. Like, it's more complicated than that. First of all, the system often chooses, you know, who becomes the celebrity activist. And second of all, unless that activist is connected to a community with accountability, it can go to your head really quickly. And I want to be clear once again, this is not some kind of like, I'm not casting stones here. There was this like tiny moment. It was about like 6 months worth of, all right. Like, when I'm a very grassroots activist, I'm, you know, not well known, but for some reason, for like 6 months within Movement for Black Lives Spaces, I was starting to get like invited to like all of these highfalutin places, like hotels, you know, nice dinners and all sorts of funders, like, you know, wanting to hear me out. And I was just like, I was starting to, I could get used to this, right? and I realized how dangerous that could be if I wasn't more grounded, maybe I was younger, maybe I was more hungry for attention. And I wished that we had, and I hope that we construct more spaces where we could help younger people move into these spaces of leadership and visibility. Because I actually don't think that the visibility is the issue. And I don't even think that the visibility, even the money, is the issue. It's more about how do you deal with that responsibly, you know. So I think that's an issue that I think about a lot. And but certainly, I mean, the hope and grief piece, you know, for me is the, that's like the lifelong struggle as you're an activist and organizer. You know, I'm 46 now. I think that I've had three major like burnout periods when literally like my back would go out and I would just have to like stay in bed for like a week. So it's not even like I learned, you know, through some wisdom, you know, to take care of myself. It's just that I ran out of youth. because the work that we do is so hard and we're confronted with these dark systems so often that, and this goes back to the whole kind of, you know, chunks of time, thinking in chunks of time, you can get so stuck in like what is happening at the moment that you miss the possibilities of what could happen in 5, 10, 15 years. And I love the conversation around hope being an active discipline, that the organizing is the hope making. And this is actually something that I learned organically, and that in many ways saved me. I wasn't sure. I don't know if it's appropriate to talk about it in this forum, but I do think it's kind of important to give you a sense of like the organizing being the hope. So I was thinking about my mom. It was recently Mother's Day. She unfortunately was killed all the way back in 1999. She was a victim of domestic abuse. As a lot of people, I was full of rage, anger, and depression when that happened. And one of the first ways that I started to heal from that was working with a group called the Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. It was in Chicago. And it was all a group of people who had lost family members to violence, but who felt that the death penalty or the carceral system was not the answer. And being in community with these people who, and organizing with them and going on lobby visits with them, gave me something that I could not have gotten out of the carceral system. In many ways, that was like my entryway into abolition before I thought about abolition. That community helped me grieve and gave me hope at the same time. And so I just, the section on hope and grief is so crucial, because those of us who are working on these systems, we're always going to be grieving. There's never going to be a moment when you don't grieve, you know. One last real quick thing is just, I was thinking about, by the time we got to the moment when there was this shooting of Black people at the Buffalo Tops supermarket, you know, a couple of months ago, it was one of many, many shootings and mass shootings that happened that was directed at Black people. at the time I was with the Undocu Black Network, and we had a meeting that day, a regular sort of staff meeting, and we were all clearly like not well. And we had someone on the team who was actually our healing justice coordinator, and she was just like, stop. Don't do what the system is telling you to do right now. Don't bypass your grief. You're feeling awful. You should feel awful about this. We're doing this quick check-in, and then we're turning off our computers, and you do what you need to do to take care of yourself. And it was just this really amazing intervention of just like, oh yeah, this country expects you to experience all of this grief and then just go back to work, you know, send your kids to school like nothing happened. And that is deeply, deeply dysfunctional. And that's not what we're trying to do here. And it reminds me of Martin Luther King's, you know, saying about how what we need is people who are socially maladjusted to this system. I think that's one of the great things about being an organizer is that you get to own your social maladjustment to this system. And so I love the portion on hope and grief.
I'm really moved by everything that everyone has said so far. My favorite chapters, the book is my favorite, the entire thing from the beginning to end. And something I wrote privately to Kelly that turned into an advertising blurb that the stealth blurb thief, Mariam, put out in the world is actually true. And that is that reading this book makes you feel like Kelly and Mariam are sitting with you talking, not talking at you, talking with you, and bringing into the conversations all of these other people, so people they've talked with, people they've read, and it becomes so convivial and so moving and full of complex thought. All of these things are true at once about this book. And when I say complex thought, for those of you who go, ooh, I don't want to read that, I don't mean complicated or, you know, abstract or vague. I mean complex like Ali was just talking about or Jairus was talking about. You get so far in figuring something out and then you run into something like, oh, I have to do the work and yet all these Black people were killed today. And the complex part seems so simple once you've gotten to it. No, don't do the work now because part of the work is grieving. Right? Part of our conviviality is figuring out how to live together. So for me, of the various chapters, the ones that really made my heart sing were organizing isn't matchmaking. I feel so profoundly committed to the necessity that the political work we do results in a provision of inalienable goods and necessities for people I despise. Like, it is so far from matchmaking. I don't want to know them. I despise them. They too need food and shelter and their own joy. Think like a geographer, because it just blows my mind that after all the conversations that I had with Kelly, that chapter appeared. And just again, folks, it's not about me. It's about an approach to thinking. But I want to share a little bit about chapter one, From Alarm to Action, because that is so perfectly tuned, so perfectly set to tune the reader to what the story or the song is. And I thought about a story to share that's not in the book. And one of the points that Kelly and Maria make in the chapter is, you know, remember what we need is, and what we're trying to produce is not just making an outrage notorious, but figuring out the action that will resolve the outrage, will resolve, you know, reduce suffering, will, you know, produce the conditions for people to reproduce their lives. And that's true, and yet notoriety matters. I mean, this is something we know from every struggle, that people have to know about it. So here's this great story. People the other day gathered to for a memorial for the great Charlene Mitchell, who passed away last December. Charlene was one of the most formidable Black communists in the United States ever. And she did many, many things, perhaps the most notorious of which was that she initiated the Free Angela and All Political Prisoners movement in 1970 when Angela Davis was captured. So Linda Burnham just shared a story with me about how she had just moved to the Bay Area, like in 1969, and she gets the call. Remember, no internet, no cell phones. She gets a call from Charlene in 1970 saying, you've got to open an office, a Free Angela and All Political Prisoners. That was the name of the movement office there in San Francisco. And Linda goes, oh, how am I going to do this? So they, in the Fillmore, which at the time was the kind of heart of Black San Francisco, they set up an office on Divisadero Street, and they went and knocked on people's doors. And what they did was they asked the people who answered their doors if the people had something called green stamps. Green stamps is something used to get as a loyalty reward for shopping in particular supermarkets, buying your groceries. And you get these stamps and you put them in a book. And when the book was full, you could get something. You could get a toaster or you could get a coffee pot. But if you got a whole lot of books of green stamps, you could get a copy machine, a ditto machine. So Linda and her comrades went door to door to door, talking to people, finding out what people thought about Angela Davis. The shootout in Marin County, it was just across the Golden Gate Bridge. Angela was, of course, already notorious. But the movement to free her and all political prisoners required some notoriety, and it required a copy machine, a Gestetner machine. So they raised the wherewithal, they GoFunded the wherewithal to get the copy machine by knocking on people's doors and getting their supermarket loyalty stamps accumulated sufficiently to do it. And just as a little coda, those machines, Gestetner machines they're called, were popularly known by two names. One, the Ditto machine, and there was this peculiar smell to them, but the other was the Spirit Duplicator. And I love the idea of a Spirit Duplicator being acquired by our comrades 50 some odd years ago in order to do the work to free Angela and all political prisoners.
Thank you all so much for those moving reflections and thoughts and stories. I could listen to you all for hours. Unfortunately, we're about at the close of the time we have for this section. So I just wanted to ask folks if they had one thought, maybe one sentence that you'd like to leave with folks as they engage with this book and celebrate this moment tonight.
Well, very quickly, I mean, I just want to hone in on what Miriam was saying in the beginning, which is, to never become numb to the things that happen, you know, in this oppressive system. That's one of the things that I love about being an activist and an organizer. Even when I'm not organizing, I know just a whole host of people who care and who refuse to accept the status quo and who refuse to become numb to it. And that has saved me so many times. So, and I think you'll find a lot of that hope and fire if you read the book. So please do and buy it and send it around.
I can add, there was a question we didn't get to around what we wish we had known. And for me, me as a childhood survivor of violence, I've been, my life and a lot of my work has been a process of chasing worthiness. And I think one lesson I would want to share that I think comes through in this book was that I was worthy because I showed up. but not necessarily because of what I completed and or what I won, because that the goal is that we keep showing up, right? We keep showing up to this work. We keep bringing more people into it. And I think through that, I realized that the contributions are in these bold attempts that we're continually making with each other in the face of what can feel really daunting. And so that's what I'm really thinking about.
I'll say one thing just briefly. One of the sub questions we were offered was, I used to think, but now I know, which is one of my favorite prompts of all time. And I'll just share that one of the beauties of this book also shapes how I have, you know, over my very long life now, learned to learn, which is this. I wish I, when I was young, I had already known to say, I used to think, but now I know. And the beauty of having that prompt always in mind is the constant unfolding of new learning, new thinking, new understanding of how it is we bring people into the work, how it is we make ourselves fit for battle, fit to fight fascism, as the great Lauren Hudson puts it, and fit to topple racial capitalism. And so there is an ongoing learning process which we do together. And this book really beautifully shows that.
Thank you all so much for that. And I just want to say that in the conversations that we had with you all while making this book, I felt not only that I learned so much that has enriched my organizing and my life, but that I got to get closer to all of you and to understand you more and to deepen our relationships. And, you know, I want folks to understand that through the things that we build, those are the joys we find. We don't always find them, right? Not every project yields a deeper relationship with someone we want to have a deeper relationship with, but that it is to be found there, you know, that in the work we find joy, we find greater relationships. And, you know, we only get these things by doing the work that we think needs to happen. So with that, Miriam.
Thank you so much, Kelly, and thank you to Ali, to Jairus, and Ruthie for your just everything, period. Just, I appreciate each of you. And I have to say that it does make me feel better every day when I get up that I know that you're also in the world, whether we're in connection or not at that moment in time, you're out there doing this work and also becoming, always becoming. And I think that's, you know, there's a poster that we're sending to the raffle winners that says abolition is becoming. And there's so much to that term and that idea and that phrase and that thinking about how when we work, we change ourselves. And as we change ourselves, we change the world. And then the world changes us back again. And it's a constant loop. It's a virtuous cycle. It's always the thing that's happening. And to speak to that, I'm so excited to share with you, and I hope those of you who stayed with us are going to appreciate this as much as I appreciate this, which is that I decided at a certain point in time as we were coming to the release of this book that the book is in part a lot of experienced organizers speaking about our experiences and trying to talk with newer and younger organizers. But we didn't have the voices of those younger organizers in the book very explicitly, even if we had them in mind. And so we decided, Kelly and I, then to sponsor a kind of last minute writing contest where we invited people to share their essays of under 3,000 words if they were new to organizing, if they'd been organizing for less than 3 years. We had over 40 submissions in a short period of time, a short window. It was very, very hard for us to make a decision about quote unquote winners. It was so hard. We initially, I budgeted for 4 people to win. And it was impossible. So we ended up selecting 8 people, quote unquote, to win. But every single person who submitted their submission to us, we valued, and we value what you shared. And we wish we could have just given everybody, 40 people, $700 each or whatever we ended up coming to, but we couldn't do that because we didn't have the budget for it. But just know that you still were winners for us as you submitted. We loved reading your submissions. Tonight, out of the 8 people that we had, we asked 3 people to just read less than 5 minutes from their essay. The important and great thing is that you get to read all of the essays, all 8 of them, fully in a zine that we made that is available digitally, that is probably being put in the chat for those of you who are on YouTube so you can have it. But for everybody else, it will also be available on our page. And when we show the slide, I guess, you'll see where you can go and access it and read along if you want to. Our first person who is going to read is unfortunately had a family emergency, and so they couldn't be with us live, but they took the time to record themselves speaking and reading their piece. And so Elaine Ballantyne, we're going to hear from Elaine, and then we're going to hear from Samu, and then we're going to close out with Yamali, who just graduated from high school this week, I think, Yamali told us. So we're excited about that. So let's start with Elaine.
Hi, everyone. This is Elaine Ballantyne, and I'm here to read you a portion of my essay, Everything Felt Normal. I have been home for 3 years now. Coming home from years of incarceration during the Trump era and during the first few months of the COVID-19 pandemic, everything felt surreal, like the world around me was burning down. But this also felt very normal. And I believed it actually helped me to reintegrate into society outside of prison. I was already accustomed to having chaos and turmoil around me. Isolation was second nature, and having the extra alone time helped me to gain some grounding during this transition period of my life. But I didn't know that my time behind bars also helped prepare me to help others, which in turn repaired a lot of the damage that being incarcerated had done to me and continues to do to so many others. People in my hometown were organizing all around me. Everyone was heated and hurt, tired, and yet ready for action. Most importantly, everyone was talking and sharing with each other. I knew in times of trouble or need within the prison system that we depended on our peers for help and support, but it was something I hadn't experienced in quite the same way outside of that system. It felt like I had left a quiet and complacent world and come back to the exact opposite. Seeing abolitionist, anti-racist mutual aid groups blossom around me was beyond inspiring. It not only gave me hope for the outside world, but it helped me to find a community that wasn't afraid of my past and could help me put that past to its best possible use. I was so tired of having to accept the fate that I seemed condemned to. I wanted to keep others from the same painful path. But I was still nervous. I felt too timid to speak up and far too insecure to be able to accomplish anything of value for anyone. I live with a lot of fear and guilt for my past actions, and I sheepishly asked the facilitator of a group I was joining if they thought anyone in the group would feel unsafe having a felon in their midst. I felt comforted when they thought I was joking. Of course I was welcome, and I wouldn't be the only person with a background. With a national incarceration rate so high, it's hard to believe that anyone who has experienced it can feel so alone. But many do, and such feelings keep us from connecting with others and using our common experiences as a tool for change. During my incarceration, I often felt helpless, trapped between the brick walls that surrounded me. Organizing, which is hardly ever easy, can often feel the same. Like nothing you do is good enough and no action has any measurable consequence. But also, like my experience of communal care during incarceration, communal care at home often relieved the loneliness and isolation of incarceration in the same ways it relieves the frustrations of organizing. Such moments of helplessness were fleeting. They unfolded into new spaces and new opportunities that would let me use those past frustrating experiences and lessons for growth and innovation. I used to be regarded as unfit and unsafe for society, the status quo of the people who sent me to prison in the first place. Through organizing, I might still be seen as a threat to that status quo, but I finally feel like the productive and healthy member of society I have always hoped to be. More of us fit into categories of oppression than we realize, and only through community connections forged by communication and collaboration can we create a world that is truly better and equal for all. Thank you.
Samyu, you're next.
Much and thank you all for having me. I feel so incredibly honored to be in this space with you all. I'm going to be reading from an essay I wrote about the UC strike that recently happened. In November 2022, I joined thousands of teaching assistants, graduate student researchers, and postdoctoral researchers on the picket line after months of contract negotiations with our employer, the University of California. For the first 2 weeks of our strike, I primarily served as a chant leader and crowd marshal for the picket line. Though I never expected to be in this role, I took it on to make sure that we had enough picket captains, since our picket lines had been modified to stay active for 12 hours straight. But this eventually became unsustainable and inaccessible. Picketing was, perhaps ironically, much more physically demanding than the labor that we were withholding from the university, and this public-facing role brought constant anxiety. When I heard that the kitchen committee of the strike was looking for help with washing dishes, I saw my perfect exit strategy. People would stop handing me megaphones if I simply joined the kitchen committee. I was warmly welcomed to their group as the new co-chair of the dishwashing subcommittee. My subsequent days on the picket line had their own routine. Arriving to the picket, I'd go upstairs to the graduate student offices, brew as many pots of coffee as I could, and help set up breakfast at the picket line. I spent the next few hours running coffee pots down to our thermos and bringing the empty pots up to refill. Along the way, I might help people who were cooking the day's lunch, running errands and locating supplies or ingredients, or keep my eye on the appliances plugged into our generator. At noon, we served lunch, setting out platters and bowls along with a hand-drawn menu that listed the day's dishes with punny names and colorful drawings of ingredients. Each day, we served a four-course meal with non-vegetarian, vegetarian, vegan, and gluten-free components in order to meet everyone's dietary needs. I'd grab a plate, quickly eat, either in solitude or with friends, and then spend the rest of the day washing the dishes from the morning's cooking. I often washed dishes in desolate apartment lounges, abandoned by everyone who did not want to cross a picket line to get into the building. But I now know where the sinks are in departments I had previously never visited. I know how to quickly soak and scrub a massive pot to get rice unstuck. I know how to angle a large sheet pan in a tiny sink to avoid splashing water everywhere. I quickly learned which faces of the front desks would glare at me as I walked back and forth with my dishes, and when to turn around and find another sink upon hearing staff wondering about whether I was allowed to be there. Over these weeks, I was coming to know information in ways I might not have been able to verbalize, but my body knew. This knowledge, stemming from this manual practice of patiently repeating something over and over again, is the transformation ever present in organizing. The Kitchen Committee's practices of reclaiming and repurposing offices and community lounges as makeshift kitchens exemplifies the creativity and imagination that organizing constantly asks of us. Though these university spaces were not built for meal preparation for hundreds, we used them as though they were. We made it so. One morning, as I carried two fresh pots of coffee to the picket, I noticed various chalk drawings around the building. On one of the pillars by the entrance to the building, a message in large letters asked, "What will you tell your kids when they ask where you were during this strike?" While the significance of this moment hit me in the beginning as I attended rallies and worked as a picket line captain, I had not considered this question in relation to my new role. When future generations see the photos of our picket lines, will they wonder who cooked lunch? Will they wonder who stayed up late for hours preparing? Will they wonder who went grocery shopping or who did the dishes? Will they wonder how it came together? Will they take it as an inexplicable miracle? With every attempt we made to focus on the joy in sharing meals and the care we took to create a space where we could feed our community, our labor and time behind the scenes also had the potential to become invisible. Now, months after our strike ended with the ratification of our new contract, the Kitchen Committee has continued to host monthly communal meals, meals for 80 to 100 people. We've also begun stocking campus fridges every 2 weeks with prepared meals for anyone who requests one, and we deliver meals to folks living in nearby neighborhoods. We feed us because we can, because we want to, but also because we still see the need to do so. Getting a new contract with updated working conditions did not wipe out graduate student food insecurity or rent burden. At the same time, the labor associated with this work is daunting. I'm shocked at how much we have been able to accomplish, and I'm also nervous about the well-being of our future selves. At the same time, I cannot help my nagging optimism. I believe there are people who are waiting and ready to help in ways that we have not yet been able to imagine. Though the strike is over, we are so lucky that Kitchen has thrived and that we have the time to continue imagining new possibilities, feeding ourselves, and sharing meals together. Everything for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing. Hi, everyone. I'm Yama Lee. I use they, them pronouns, and I'm from the South Side of Chicago. I identify as an undocumented queer person, and my essay is titled Undocu Organizing, the Experience of an Immigrant Organizer. So I'm going to read a portion of my essay. So, Immigrant Story and the History of My Ancestors. In the summer of 2010, my life was uprooted in response to gang violence occurring in Central America. My maternal grandfather was shot dead by a member of a gang in Guatemala. As a result, my parents deemed Guatemala, our native country, to be unsafe for raising children. Later, for a Latin American studies course during my senior year of high school, I researched and discovered that the gang issues that plague Guatemala and other Central American countries were an aftermath of the country's tragic history during the Cold War. The civil war in Guatemala began in the 1960s due to the repressive government perpetration of political and economic inequities that were especially harmful to indigenous people of Mayan descent. As an act of resistance, the Mayan people formed various guerrilla groups to challenge the government, and in the 1970s, the Guerrilla Army of the Poor was formed. In 1980, the Guatemalan government was, with support of US-backed forces, aimed to end the guerrilla movement and specifically targeted the Mayan population and anyone suspected of involvement with the guerrillas. In the end, the US-backed Guatemalan military government was responsible for the killings or disappearance of nearly 200,000 indigenous people. This tragic event in history is also known as the Silent Holocaust, and it directly impacted my family. In the 1980s, my paternal great-grandfather was kidnapped by the Guatemalan government and accused of guerrilla involvement. He shared that he had been rescued by the guerrillas from being murdered at the hands of the U.S.-backed Guatemalan government officials. The direct link I have to this historical event makes it very personal and pushes me to learn more about the way systems have marginalized people in my community and beyond. The U.S. believed it important to stamp out the guerrilla movement as part of the effort to end the spread of communism. During El Salvador's civil war in the 1980s, guerrillas and civilians were also targeted by U.S.-backed forces. Refugees from both Guatemala and El Salvador fled up north for sanctuary from the ongoing warfare. However, when they arrived, they were not granted refugee status and had to live in the states as undocumented immigrants, with limited access to resources and opportunities. The impoverished living conditions of undocumented immigrants drove some to commit nonviolent crimes that landed them in jail. During their imprisonment, it is believed that some of these individuals turned to gangs as a means of survival inside U.S. jails and prisons. This dynamic produced the sociological phenomenon known as the Mara Salvatrucha, or MS-13, notoriously as the most dangerous gang in the world. The Clinton administration responded to the gangs by enforcing harsh immigration policies, deporting foreign-born residents to the Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. This led to the ongoing cycle of migration, deportation, and violence, with no direct way to disrupt the pattern. To this day, Central American families similar to mine continue migrating north to escape the terrorizing gangs and to seek better conditions. The struggles of new arrivals. While transitioning to my new American life in hopes of achieving the American dream, I was pressured into assimilation. I was 5 years old and had no understanding of why I had to leave my home. I questioned everything. Pero por qué, mami? This was my rejection of assimilation. I did not want to eat burgers from McDonald's. I wanted my frijoles negros and plátanos. I refused to listen and dance to Taylor Swift. I wanted my salsa music. I hated the snow. I missed my year-long spring weather. Despite my resistance to assimilation, I gradually grew accustomed to the new American lifestyle. 2 years into our lives in the U.S., there was no significant improvement in our living conditions. Both of my parents worked long hours at low-wage jobs, so they rarely had time to spend with me. Gangs were as prevalent in Chicago as they had been back in Guatemala. During the summer of 2012, as I was leaving my apartment complex to attend daycare, a police officer asked me for my father's whereabouts. Naively, I told the police officer, and my father was handcuffed and arrested in front of me. Out of desperation and exhaustion of living paycheck to paycheck, my father had stolen money from an unattended gas station. He served a couple years in the Cook County Department of Corrections and eventually was deported back to Guatemala. As a young child, I had a binary understanding of ethics. I thought, my dad broke the law, therefore he is a bad person and needs to deal with the consequences. This thought process was a result of assimilating to America's individualistic culture. Later on, this experience became embedded into my purpose for committing to social justice. Without the support of my father, the family dynamic shifted and my mother became our sole provider. As the oldest of four children, I took on the responsibility of being the family caretaker and organizer. Through trial and error, I found a balance that stabilized my family. In retrospect, my familial responsibilities were my first real-world experience as an organizer. My siblings and I collaborated with one another to accomplish a shared goal, which was maintaining our family's well-being and success. So yeah, that's all I have for y'all, but y'all can read the rest of it in the zine. Thank you.
Okay, first of all, so much gratitude to Elaine, to Samu, to Yamile for sharing those personal reflections, for reflecting on organizing, for expanding the vision of what organizing is and can be and how and where we do it and how we do it. I know you all are going to jump at reading the zine immediately. I could not, literally, I was just like, you could see how hard it was for us to decide on how to choose anybody from this long list of people who shared so much with us. So gratitudes to all of you. Thank you for being here with us tonight. And we are thrilled you're in the movement. We hope you will stay in the movement. And we should all do our best to lift you up as you continue to struggle and fight into the future. So thank you for that. We're just going to end now because we're a little bit over, but it's not by far. I think that everybody who hopefully got to be part of this today and to listen and to share and to be part of this can sense from us the real camaraderie, comradeship, love, care that we all feel for each other, including people who we've just met. And that's what organizing at its best can be and do. And we hope that this book helps you all do that. And in order to do that, we created a whole bunch of resources. Rachel Zafer created a wonderful discussion guide that you can use with your peers, your comrades, your community members to talk about this book. We created a wonderful workbook, which is more in depth, which has an incredible souped up discussion guide by Ursula Wolf, and then beautiful illustrations from Sayari Rifai, comments and prompts from Kelly and myself. And this workbook will be tied to something we're going to be doing in the fall. So stay tuned. Kelly and I will be hosting about a 6 or 7 week conversation cohort for newer organizers to get together and use the book and conversations with some of the people we invited to speak about organizing to have conversations with each other. And I think we are planning to start that October 17th. It'll be on Tuesday nights from like 6:30 to whatever. And we will send an application around for people who want to join that and be in constant conversation, a continued conversation around themes in the book and more, whatever you want to bring to bear. We also include the zine from these wonderful submissions that we received. That's also available for download. And we have a playlist, which you heard a piece from, and we'll carry us out on the piece from the playlist, which is a collectively made playlist by many of the people who were interviewed in the book, shared some of their suggestions for music they wanted to include. Kelly and I shared suggestions. You know, use it, and we hope that you enjoy it. And then finally, of course, I couldn't not make another zine. So Rachel Zafer and myself collaborated to make a zine based on my obsession with tea, because I'm obsessed with tea. And I think everything goes well with tea. And I think this book goes well with tea. So we have a zine called Steeped in, Let This Radicalize You, which has suggestions of teas for each chapter of the book. And the teas are basically my favorite teas. With like, you know, some cool little descriptions. Drink it on the, you'll be on a Parisian cafe while you drink this, you know, whatever. We try to make it inviting to you. So I hope that you find it, in the spirit that we offer it, which is the spirit of joy and support and camaraderie. And so thank you all so, so very much for joining us. I'm gonna let Kelly take us out. But before we do that, just want to also let folks know, please don't forget to let people know about the book. Because to me, this is really, as I mentioned earlier, it's a word of mouth book. It's not a book that is going to be, you know, out there on all the talk shows or whatever. And that's not what it was meant for. It's meant to get in the hands of organizers, and particularly newer, younger organizers. So if you buy a copy for yourself, buy one for a new organizer in your life and share it with them as well, and have a conversation with them about that book. That's really important to us. This idea of intergenerational conversation, collaboration, comradeship is so important. You know, we need to have ways to learn from each other. I learned so much from my touchstones who are older than I was, who had more experience than I was. I hope that I have shared some of my knowledge with younger people, and I hope younger people will share it with younger than them, and we'll keep it going like a lineage and a chain. So thank you for all your support. I'm going to throw to Kelly. Kelly's going to take us out.
Thank you for that. And I just want to say how inspiring it was to listen to our readers. Thank you for your contributions to the zine. It just means the world to hear your stories and to be able to learn from you as we're sharing our own stories. And I want to thank our friends who joined us on this call, Ruthie, Ali, Jairus. I love you all. It has meant the world to be part of this collaborative creation that we've all contributed to together. And I'm just grateful that this book is out in the world. And I hope that all of you out there, as Miriam said, take the pieces that enrich your work and your lives and leave behind whatever doesn't. And that we're able to cross paths someday in this work that we do together, and that our movement of movements will get it done, and that we will build this revolution of reciprocal care together and create the future that we all know needs to exist. So thank you and good night.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.